Welcome to the For the Reef podcast. Each week we bring our fish nerd conversations from the fish room floor to your living room. We try to bridge the gap between the saltwater aquarium hobby and coral reef conservation. Now, here are your hosts, fisheries biologist and founder of For the Reef Apparel, Mitch Dender, with local fish store owner and first responder, Ian Bell.
We have a little bit of a fundraiser going right now. Ian, if you want to explain that part of it.
So through my shop and in conjunction with the Eco Divers Reef Foundation and Adaptive Reef, they make control boards and whatnot for the saltwater aquarium hobby. They have donated three of their control boards to me to give away. So all we're asking you to do is like our Facebook page for the Reef podcast and go on to our GoFundMe for the Eco Divers Reef Foundation and donate whatever you can. $2, $10, $100, whatever you can do. And that'll get you into the draw and you could win one of these things for your aquarium.
Yeah.
So thanks to Kyle Elder for donating that. That was really generous of him.
That's really, really awesome. So make sure you get on there. I mean, it's just a donation. It's a win-win situation. You make a donation, you help the Eco Divers, and you get your chance to win one of those control boards, which I have right now, and I love.
We'll get the links put up somewhere for those too.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not familiar with what we're talking about, when you're setting up your control board for, you know, your Apex, so you've got all your wires running all over the place, this control board basically keeps everything organized. It has a bunch of different slots and things like that so that you can really make your system look pretty sleek. And it also keeps it, keeps it safe and all that sort of thing. So
Wire management. It's they're pretty awesome things. I've got several in my shop. I use them in all the installs we do. They're great.
Yeah.
And hopefully this will be the first of many of this kind of thing. I've reached out to other folks that I know in the aquarium industry, and they've expressed interest in helping us with this kind of thing. I know Chad over at Reef Nutrition has said that they would help me do something, and some others. So it's just taking me a little while to get to it, but hopefully we'll keep that going.
Yeah. So our main two topics that we were going to talk about today is a project that Ian and I are taking on right now. We're going to try and breed some urchins. And then I've also had some other projects going on the side for something called aquaponics. If you've never heard of it, it's basically using fish as the engine to grow food. To grow plants and vegetation. So I'll explain all that. First things is always something that we kind of do is this kind of give a summary of a couple of things that are going on right now in the coral conservation segment that we're aware of. One thing that is kind of bad news that I'll just give you guys the bad news first, and then Ian has some good news as well. The bad news is over the last few weeks, I started seeing articles coming out about a coral that I really love. It's the pillar coral in the Florida Keys. If you're not familiar with pillar coral, it looks like several towers shooting up from the seafloor.
If you're in a cave, like a stalactite or stalagmite, I forget which one's up and down.
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
And they are one of the few species of coral that are in the Caribbean and Florida Keys that offer structural diversity in the water column, which provides habitat for fish and all kinds of things. So they're a really, important species. And so I've read that the pillar coral in this paper that was published in the Frontiers in Marine Science documented that the species is now considered functionally extinct. So what that means would mean that they are no longer capable of sustaining their populations on their own. I think that means that there's only a few of them left. I remember talking to the folks at Force Blue, and they're really tied in with the Florida coral reefs, and they said that there was basically one strong colony left, but the pillar corals are really being wiped out by the tissue loss disease. So again, it's not exactly the stony coral tissue loss disease. So that's the same one that we're always talking about, the Cayman Eco Divers. It's just this this, you know, disease that pops up kind of without much warning. And
they're still trying to sort of lock down what it is.
Yeah, what causes it and all that kind of stuff. So really unfortunate. Another, you know, one of my favorite stories I ever heard in coral conservation was from those guys at Force Blue. We were having dinner together, and they were talking about this, you know, pillar coral in the Florida Keys, where they were brought in there. So the Force Blue is a, I'm sure we've talked about them in the past, but they're a group of ex-military service members from the U.S. that are now using all those skills to rebuild coral reefs specifically. Well, I guess most prominently right now in the Florida Keys. So they had the story was a real tearjerker. Basically, they had a hurricane that knocked over the last known big colony of pillar coral in Florida. So they called in these guys because they thought the pillar coral is basically leaning on its side. Brown, it's starting to show signs of death. And this thing is absolutely massive. You know, it's the equivalent of, let's say, a grand piano flipped over on the bottom of the seafloor. So you need some pretty specialized skills to get that up. So everyone in the area thought this thing's a goner. So that was really tough. They called up the guys at Force Blue. They said, that's no problem, we can do that easily. So they get down there, they had lift bags and concrete underwater, and they're doing full blown construction underwater to get this thing back upright. And they succeed, and they get the pillar coral sitting upright. And as they said, they were underwater, and this pillar coral went from signs of death to, once it was standing straight up, it was like it exploded in color. It got new oxygen flowing in from the currents and new sunlight. And the pillar coral decided it was going to come back. And within seconds, they said, the colors started to show up and fish started swimming in, as if you just opened the door to their house that was flipped over. So when they got back up onto the boat, they were kind of celebrating or whatever. And he mentioned that there was a couple dive guys who were there, dive instructors, that were crying. And he said, you know, why are you guys crying? It's time to celebrate. And the guy said, I've been diving here my entire life. At the end of every dive, we always know to go back to the pillar coral and come up to the surface. So when we thought we lost that pillar coral, it was devastating. They said it felt like we lost a family member. And to see you guys bring this coral back to life was emotional for them. So that was a really cool story. They tell it better than I do. So if you guys want to hear it straight from them, go check out some of the different documentaries that they've been putting out recently. They're doing some great work in Florida.
I imagine CRF and people like that have taken some samples and are trying to grow them out, but on its own, they think there's too far and few and far between for them to breed naturally. It's going to have assistance. And that's the same thing they're trying to do in Cayman, because they're very low there as well. They have been given permission by the government to take samples. They are on a tree and growing out. So that's an uphill battle in both places.
Yeah, that article did say that there was 400 to 500 fragments of pillar corals that are in different aquariums. Florida Aquarium is the biggest one that holds on to the pillar coral right now, as far as I know. And they actually had success in spawning pillar coral in captivity, a wild pillar coral in captivity, for the first time, I think, in like the last, you know, 8-9 months. So definitely some good stories there, but obviously the bad ones being that the stony coral tissue loss disease is affecting pillar coral right now in Florida Keys.
Hmm. So my news is a little bit more positive than that. You know, now that sort of lockdown's over and things are getting back to somewhat normal in certain places, the eco divers in Cayman had gotten out and started to it's time to go out and survey our areas and see what's happening. They do that probably once a year and just see, has things improved, or things, or is our plan working? What kind of populations are we getting? How's it going? I've participated in this a couple times. Basically, it's you get a few divers and you stretch yourselves a certain amount of distance apart and you swim over an area with a wax board and you count corals, literally count corals. And so these particular survey, they were looking for the Acropora cervicornis. And we'll touch again with Aaron on what they do, but Aaron's approach has become a little different. It used to be they would take the corals off the trees and outplant them. Now they're creating coral trees at various positions all around the island so that they interbreed with each other in between the planted areas. And it's really working well. So he went out, look, June 26th, he posted. He said, today we counted the Acropora cervicornis corals between Sunset House and Dodd Foster's nurseries. We watch these survey counts grow every year. And after grow every year after our coral nursery spawns. Today's count was 297 individuals and 36 patches of Acropora cervicornis. And that's quite something because I've seen where there's none. So this is all coming off the interspawning between the coral trees. This is an increase of over 50 times the amount present on our original surveys. And they were going to go back out the following Saturday and just do a double count to see where it is. So it's proof of concept. Things are going well there. They're interbreeding between the different coral sites, and they're trying to set this up around the whole island to get them growing back again on their own rather than just straight out planting them.
So
that's pretty cool.
That's amazing news.
And when we get Aaron on, I guarantee he'll tell us a lot more about it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Look forward to that.
Yeah, me too.
All right. So then getting into kind of our main topics.
Yeah.
First off, I guess, you know, we're not that far into it, so we can quickly go through what the plans are for breeding urchins. So urchins obviously have a critical role on coral reefs and managing algae. There's also really good papers out right now by Jamie Craigs, who has shown that trying to rear coral babies, basically, with urchin babies helps with the coral's ability to attach and start to grow. That's a really crude juvenile way of explaining
it. This is a pretty crucial part of it.
Yeah, because basically the urchins are eating the algae that otherwise would be competing with the coral for placement in the tanks where he's trying to grow them. So urchins are and not only that, as we know from the aquarium hobby, urchins are exceptional at cleaning up your tank, and they're also really cool. And lots of people, I can say this for sure. I have with this tank that I have, and none of you guys can see it, but Ian can see it. With this tank, you know, I'm obsessed with the corals. And every time I have people over here, they ask me about the fish, and then they ask me about a crab. And typically, if they find an urchin, they're talking to me about urchins. So urchins are just a really cool thing in the tank that for when you want to shock and awe people when they see your tank, urchins are just something that are interesting and part of the cleanup crew. So why not try to breed them? So here's the plan. So we're going to try and document this because I think that, all information about breeding and all of that stuff, it should be, you know, documented and spread, and it should be, you know, there's no point in holding back information and breeding. I think it's despicable when people do that, and I won't be the person to do that. So the best that I can do is try and share as much of our success and failure with this urchin breeding. The other thing is that it's not like we're reinventing the wheel here.
No.
These urchins have been bred in, you know, lots of different urchins have been bred in captivity. So we're just following along and seeing if we can do it ourselves.
Yeah, we've been talking about trying to breed a few things for a while, and for two reasons, well, three reasons. What? A, it's freaking cool, and B, we want to hopefully engage you guys to try and breed things yourselves and take part. Like, there's ways for you to physically take part in conservation and breeding and all that kind of thing. And also, this is a way for us to engage further into the work that's being done and sort of create that connection for us to take us to the next learning level ourselves in what's being done and how it's being done.
Mm-hmm. So the plan is I'm going to take some urchins and put them into my fish room and try breeding them. So there's several ways to do it. There's temperature induced ways where you can bring the temperature up in the tank and drop the temperature out quickly. And that sometimes will trigger spawning in certain urchins. There's other ways where just raising the temperature up into the higher range will get them going and they'll spawn. And then the other way, which is the way that I think we'll probably do, is you basically inject potassium chloride into the gonads of the urchin. So where the mouth is of the urchin, if you flip an urchin over and you take a, what's the gauge? I think it's like a 20 gauge syringe and inject it into that area where its mouth is, that fleshy tissue, you can access the gonads through there. So I think the idea with potassium chloride is when it's in low doses, you inject it there and it basically stimulates the gonads to contract, which pushes out whatever's in it. So that pushes out the gametes or the egg or the egg or sperm. So with these urchins, the idea is you let them do their thing in the tank. And then I'm going to have to read up on what the signs are that they may be ready, because we're going to have some different sizes. But once we have that figured out, we'll either induce them for spawning with temperature or potassium chloride. It also allows us, by controlling the spawning trigger, it allows us to do this more than once a year. Once they start to spawn, you'll see either a fogginess, which is the sperm coming out of the urchin, or you'll have the eggs, which are coming out of the urchin. So they're like more like a clear, clusters of eggs that you can see. And if you just Google the urchin eggs and urchin sperm, you'll see the difference in what I'm talking about. But if you just flip the individuals over upside down on top of a beaker, the egg and sperm will fall through the water column. And then you basically need to mix them. So we're going to suspend them into a tank where the water is just going to keep tumbling with a bubbler, keeping the oxygen level up. And hopefully that mixes it well enough that we get a good bunch of urchins. So that's the plan.
And if anybody out there listening has experience with this or has done it, please reach out. Mm-hmm. We welcome your experiences. We've been researching through, I know Mitch reads a lot. We've been looking at YouTube and some videos and stuff, but we're happy to take hints from folks that have done before and learn from your successes or failures.
Yeah. I mean, and this could even be, from a personal reef keeping standpoint, if I'm able to produce a whole bunch of juvenile urchins. So the thing is with urchins is, one, when they get really big, depending on the species, sometimes they can be bulldozers in your aquarium and they tip over corals and blah, blah, blah. And the other thing I've heard is that as they go through different life cycles or as they get older, urchins change the type of algae that they prefer. So having, if you only get adult urchins that you're buying, they're only, more likely to only eat certain types of algae. So it would be really cool, and I bet you it would be really beneficial to take, if I do get a spawn of juvenile urchins, and put some of them into my personal tank, and hopefully they help with those, really small microalgae that are competing for space with my corals, and maybe that'll help my corals spread out even more in the tank, which would just be cool.
For sure.
We're also, the plan is we're going to try Tuxedo Origins.
Yeah.
So
only because they have application in our area. We could do long spines, which is a lot of what is getting done right now, but we're going to try these and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's plan.
We're also looking at next, we're hoping to enjoy peppermint shrimp perhaps.
Yeah, that's another one I would love to do. I have a wicked aptasia issue right now in my tank, and I have I've talked about it on another podcast, but I have Melanaris wrasse and a hawkfish in there. So peppermint shrimp end up as just, you know, tasty morsels most of the time. So if I could learn how to breed them, and it's going to save me some money to putting shrimp in there to try and combat the urchins. I know there's other ways of, or the combat the aptasia, but the and I know there's lots of different ways of doing it. The other reason is I just really think peppermint shrimp are cool, and it would be cool to even do cleaner shrimps too.
Yeah, it would.
And there's always a demand for peppermint shrimp. People are always looking for them, and a lot of times they're out of season. So this helps with the storefront. And, you know, hopefully we can get some captive raised peppermints in at Ian's shop, which,
yep, that's the goal.
Yeah. Great for, folks shopping there too.
Yeah.
So the other little project,
because Mitch doesn't have enough to do.
Yeah. So something I've gotten, I've been really interested in something called aquaponics for a long time, going back to, even, you know, high school, I was thinking that instead of going to university, I wanted to just take a course on aquaponics and just try to be a farmer. I didn't end up doing that. And, it probably, who knows? I don't know. Maybe it wasn't for the best, or it was, I don't know. Maybe I'd really be doing some farming right now, but aquaponics is basically, using fish as a source of fertilizer for plants, and growing them in a multi-trophic, I guess, way of raising fish and growing food. So if you think of issues with monocultures is what I'm talking about. And that means like growing rows and rows and rows of corn. This is a different approach where you grow different animals or different things together that feed off each other or help each other so that they can, you know, so that it's more sustainable. Aquaponics actually uses 5% of the water compared to traditional farming. So there's that, which is, you know, massive sustainability wise, massive. The other thing that it does from a sustainability point of view is its footprint is a lot smaller. You can grow plants butted up together in a really small footprint compared to growing things out in a field, for example. There's no soil, for example, is another thing that is a sustainability thing. So in aquaponics, one nice way to do aquaponics, and the main way that it's done commercially, is through deep water culture. So that's where you you have plants growing in water. They send their roots down into the water and they take out what they need from the water rather than having to take it from soil. So you have no loss from recycling or throwing away soil after you've grown your plants and all of that. But getting back to kind of the fundamentals of it, if you just think about the way that this ecosystem works in the wild, right? We have fish, which are consuming whatever they eat. They then produce ammonia in the water. And we know all this from our reef keeping, experience with cycling a tank.
And some of us are doing that and not even sort of relating it to this. You're doing that with your refugium.
Exactly.
You put your potato in the sump and you're doing the exact same thing.
Yeah. And in a way, you know, everybody who's got a refugium with chato is doing aquaponics.
Yeah, you're thinking of it in reverse because you're trying to keep your tank clean. But if you were to think of it in Mitch's concept, you're a plant from the nutrient in the water.
Right. So as they produce ammonia, which is the byproduct of you know, them consuming food and being alive, they will excrete ammonia. That ammonia then is converted into nitrite and eventually nitrate by nitrifying bacteria that are in the water. Once that is converted into nitrate, it's bioavailable for plants in the form of nitrogen to grow plants. So it's a incredible source of nutrients for the plants to grow. So rather than putting fertilizer into the water, you are feeding your fish, and your fish are doing the work, and the bacteria are converting the waste product into something that's available for food for your plants. And then you can even eat the plants. So there's lots of species of lettuce, all kinds of different things. You name it, you can grow it in aquaponics. So what I've done, I've been putting off doing any aquaponics because of all kinds of different reasons, you know, space or money or noise or different things. And then finally I just said, whatever, I'm just gonna, I have a tank in the basement that has some fish in it. Some native species, crappie, and there's some bluegills in there.
That's the name of the fish. He doesn't just hate that fish.
yeah. Crappie is a great fish and, very yummy. And, I have a tank downstairs where they've been growing out. So I took a styrofoam, piece of styrofoam. I drilled holes into the styrofoam, and then I got little net cups with sponges in them, and I put plants all through them and allowing that to float in the surface of the water. So this is a really basic way of doing aquaponics and deep water culture. I took some lettuce that was straight out of the ground, and I grew some lettuce that was from seed. I also was growing a what are they called?
Do you have any pictures you can post on our Facebook, Mitch?
Yeah.
People can see what you're talking about.
Yeah. And it was so simple. I mean, all I did was just raise my lights up higher, put the plants on top, and now the plants are cleaning the fish tank. And to go one step further, I wanted to complete the cycle. So I have a worm culture in the basement right now too. So I do a lot of fishing. So having worms around is always good for fishing. It's also nice for worms are great for the fish to eat. So now it's a waste-free type of system now. So the plants, a lot of times, you know, you'll be pruning plants, or there'll be parts of the plants that need to be thrown away, or, you know, scraps from the kitchen or whatever that need to be composted. You take the plants from that you're growing for aquaponics, the stuff that you're pruning off, or it's no good, or it dies or whatever, you throw it into the worm culture. The worms then compost that lettuce and stuff like that, and then you can use the worms to feed the fish, and then the fish feed the plants, and then the plants feed the worms, and then the worms feed the fish. So
I feel like you're about to sing.
So it's a perfect little system down there. I get all kinds of looks.
My kids have a song like that.
Yeah. So it's just funny, right? Like the ecosystems in the wild have shown us how they grow, and we can use all of that to grow food in a more sustainable, cheaper, more nutritious. There's no fertilizers. There's nothing like that way of growing food. So that is the small scale aquaponics project that's going on in the basement right now.
Interesting.
And what's really interesting is, so for example, with the lettuce, I had two, things of lettuce that were growing in a pot for a while, and they were doing all right. They weren't growing very much, and they were kind of like, you know, soft and really leafy, limp kind of lettuce that isn't the most appetizing. It wasn't growing very fast. It didn't look too healthy. I took those and I put them into the aquaponic system. Within a week, roots were growing several inches out of the base into the water column. So it looks cool for the fish, because now the fish would all swim through these roots. And then, and the lettuce started standing straight up and is growing way faster. So there's no more energy that's being put into sending roots through soil. That energy is going straight up into the harvestable part of the plant, which is the part that you're growing the plant for anyway.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah. And you can do all kinds of different aquaponics. There's like, you know, and I'm just saying deep water culture, but you can also do grow beds where the water, you know, goes through a settling tank and then it flows into, you know, a bed of like lava rocks. And what people do, it's called a bell siphon. So there's a siphon. It's basically like a tube upside down with a cap over it. So the water in the tub will slowly rise. We're talking about a tiny, tiny little pump will run the whole system. So the system, the tub will slowly rise and the water will kind of flood the whole system. And then it'll hit the top of the bell siphon and it'll automatically create a siphon through the bell siphon. And the bell siphon will go until it drains completely. So it'll quickly drain. So it slowly fills up and then quickly drains out. So the roots of the plants that you're growing, they get a really, really, really good soak, and then they get a chance to be dry again. So for species that don't do very well in submerged conditions like deep water culture, you grow them in these other beds where you can literally grow anything. You can grow, you know, carrots, cucumber, tomatoes, what, anything you want, you can grow it in aquaponics, and it's cool.
Interesting. I don't know if I told you this. One of the guys on my fire department does this. He has a greenhouse. He was looking at doing it with fish, but I think he went a different route. But he's got rows and rows and rows and rows of those white pipes with the holes in it, and they grow a lot of lettuce and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's another way of doing it. It's like a flow through, so the root doesn't stay completely submerged. It just has water washing over it at all times. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't raise fish because, you know, I don't know why. I mean, some people don't want to deal with the fish or whatever. Me being, you know, from the aquarium hobby, raising fish is probably the easiest part to me.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of species that you can grow. So the main one in aquaponics is Blue Nile tilapia. Tilapia is a fish that gets a bad rep. Because of the hardiness of tilapia, they are grown in really bad conditions all over around the world, but mostly, you know, in Asian countries and in South America, they're grown out in really terrible conditions. Like, I mean, I've seen videos of tilapia sitting underneath chicken coops, and they would eat the chicken shit. and they would grow. I've seen them, the tilapia used in zoos to break down the excrement of hippos. So they're a fish that they survive in anything. They come from still water, and they're really hardy, and they can also live in really, really, really tight schools without feeling stress. So you can pack them in. For that reason, when you get them in the supermarket, they're also usually frozen several times. So you end up getting this kind of mushy, crappy fish when you eat tilapia. But if you were to eat a tilapia that was raised in North America, raised in North America, you can get them from overseas. And as long as they're raised in a humane and ethical way that focuses on the quality of the fish, then tilapia can be really, really tasty. So that is another reason why people raise tilapia. They also grow really fast. So tilapia as a tropical fish, they'll be at, you know, 78 degrees, upwards to 80 sometimes, and you keep the water heated, and then they can grow really fast. And tilapia will basically go stagnant in the 60s. They won't grow at all, so you can't put them in those temperatures, but they'll grow to marketable, sellable, eatable size in 9 months. So that's why it's the most prominent fish. What I would be more interested in raising are some of our native species here. Bluegill is a really a really good one to raise in captivity. For aquaponics, they also can handle cool temperatures. So living in a cold climate, you don't have to worry about that. Perch is another one that perch would be amazing to breed in captivity. I could talk for a while about perch if you want to go there.
I think what we need to do, because we've hinted at this a few times, is we need to do an episode where you get to talk about the work that you've done with salmon and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, for
I
sure.
I think that would be interesting for people as a sort of segue from this sort of natural next step for you to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, that's where I had experience with hatcheries and stuff. And I've learned about, you know, larger scale hatchery systems that that grow fish commercially. You learn a lot. And I'll just go there with perch because it's been at the top of my mind. So perch as a grow out fish, aquacultured or aquaponically grown in Ontario or in Canada, I think it's just an awesome fish to do that with, because perch is recognized in these areas, you know, Southern Ontario and all over Canada, really. Actually, probably anywhere you go, perch is recognized as a really great fish to eat. They're not the cheapest to buy in supermarkets or in restaurants. So a lot of times people don't get to eat them as much as they want to. So it would be cool to be able to rear them in captivity. Perch, however, have a really difficult early life cycle to raise them in captivity. So they go through several stages of life and of what they eat. So to basically explain this in a quick way, in the wild, adult perch will spawn basically big egg nests that are kind of transparent, and they kind of float up in the water column, and they're like big blobs that are floating in the bed of the algae and stuff like that that are growing in the water along the stream bed, riverbed. And then those eggs actually create, when the fish is born in what we would call kind of like a baby fish, they don't even have fins. They haven't even developed fins. They are transparent. They're tiny, 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 tiny. And they can't really stalk prey, and they have horrible vision. So to get one of those fish to eat, you have to first off feed them live food. So brine shrimp or something similar to that, you know, baby Nepal eye or whatever. And then you've got to keep those live foods in an overabundance inside the tank. So anytime you're rearing small fish, you have ratios on how much live food you want to put with them so that you don't foul the tank. And that's how much they need to actually catch. But with perch, they're basically floating through the water column and they hope something lands in their mouth. So if you want to replicate that in captivity, you really got to hit them with a lot of food. So that's challenging. And then as they get older, they have to be converted to the adult brine shrimp. There's a lot of different growth rates, it seems like, and you get a huge die-off period. And basically once you're out of that period, you get past the die-off, they're pretty hardy. Like the baby fish, then from that point, you can get them on to like a crumbly dry food and start to grow them out. But to get them to that stage is really difficult. So it's hard to buy fingerling perch to raise in captivity. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be to go there. It's just one more project I'd love to set up for, you know, a master's or a honors thesis student or something like that to get the funding to go and work on rearing juvenile perch. Because why not?
Yeah. Well, it sounds, just listening to you, it sounds like a lot of the challenges there are similar to the things we've been listening to about breeding certain fish in the aquarium hobby as well. All comes down to food size and quantity.
Yep. Food is the is the always seems to be the most difficult thing. Once you can get those fish to breed, you've got to get a way to feed them, and you've got to do it in a way that doesn't mess up the quality of the water. So, right. Yeah.
Interesting.
So that was my little aquaponics lesson for you, Ian. You can set up an aquaponics system at the house now.
I would love to. Amongst everything else that's going on. One of these days, we will try that for sure. Something like that anyways, maybe on a small scale.
Yeah, it's something actually. I have a good friend that is a farmer and has a section in his building. And I talked to him about doing a small aquaponics plot inside of their test out. He was way open for the idea.
Nice.
But I just thought, I felt like I knew everything I need to know to do it, but I didn't have the experience yet. So I wanted to, on my own space and time and money, learn right. all this, how to do it on my own. And then maybe one day.
Yeah.
Cause it is, you know, all of the other stuff aside, the sustainability part of aquaponics seems like a place we need to go to take the miles off the food and all that good stuff. So, yeah.
Right on. So yeah, so, as you can see, we've been busy in our absence, lots of things in the works, but there's not enough hours in the day sometimes. So it's taken us a bit to get back to you guys.
Yeah. So it's good to be back though. It's
We're excited about it.
You know, I love to talk all these ideas out on the podcast and just keep these ideas flowing. And
yeah, we're pretty excited about some of the guests we've got up, and we've got some interesting things that are in the very early stages that we'll tell you guys about when they're a little bit more firmed up that we're involved in. And I'm pretty excited about in terms of being more directly involved in a reef conservation than we already are. So that's exciting.
For sure.
Can't give away too much yet because it's still very early.
Right. So.
So. Okay. From my standpoint, trying to bring the store out of lockdown into slow season, challenging. Mm-hmm. So that takes up a lot of our time right now. You got to head to the grindstone kind of thing. But other than that, done some renos in the store, and I have a couple of big builds that I'm working on right now, and they're pretty exciting. So maybe we'll do a chat about them. You know, I'm working on a 650 gallon and a full fish room for a fella, and I've got a 350 with a fish room that's going to run two tanks out of it. Then they're basically building the house around it, and that one's upcoming. So we're just gathering the stuff for that right now, and it's pretty good. It's going to be pretty awesome. We're pretty stoked about that.
Yeah, that sounds like an awesome idea. What we should do is next time you're at those builds, take a few pictures. We'll post them on Instagram, and then we'll talk them all out on the podcast. Because some of these systems, like, you can't even get close to these systems. Most people can't ever imagine doing some of the systems that you get to work on and help build. And
it's been fun. So. It's a learning curve for me too. There's things that we've had to figure out. There's, you know, we're dealing with a different level of size than, like you said, most people are used to, or even that I'm used to. So I'm getting to deal with equipment that I never thought I'd get to touch, which is pretty awesome. And just the logistics of doing it and then thinking about it and keeping up with it and the amount of work that's involved. The fellow with the 650 started this build on his own and quickly realized he runs a fairly large company, and he realized that he didn't have time to do mm-hmm. both. And sometimes we don't always consider the time that's required to do this. Even now we're trying to get it built and done the way he would like, but problems develop, there's phosphate issues, there's all sorts of things going on that we're trying to get under control before we go to the next step. And it's much different on a big scale like that.
For sure.
So pretty cool though. He's got some awesome fish in that tank. There's a blonde naso in that tank that's my favorite. It's the very first fish he put in with the streamers on it. That thing's got to be 14, 15 inches long. It's amazing fish. It's a big fat fish.
That's awesome.
Comes right up to the glass every time you're there. He's awesome.
Nice. Yeah, that's
yeah, we'll definitely get some pictures. We'll post them on the site and stuff like that so you can follow along, because they're going to be pretty fun. Be automated and all sorts of, you know, nice to haves, not need to haves, but, you know, fun things for us to play with.
Sweet. Alrighty. And, you know what, I was also just thinking, I was rambling all about that tilapia and food and all that stuff. There's a book that I'd love to recommend to people. It's called Four Fish. I've got it over there and I'm going to go grab it, but I'm trying to remember who the author is. It is by Paul Greenberg. So I read this book a while ago and I like just flew through it. And it's basically all about the future of fish for food. And he basically walks through everything you can imagine in aquaculture and wild fisheries and the types of fish that we consume. And he specifically comments on four fish being cod, salmon, bass, and tuna. So really, really interesting book. Highly recommend it if anybody's looking for a new read.
Cool. One other thing I wanted to mention, Mitch, was that the email that you sent to me the other day from Joe McDonough. He was listening to our podcast. He had some real nice things to say. And one of the things he was asking about is how he could support the show. And that's something we hadn't really considered yet. We just started doing this because we like doing it. But we'll definitely figure out some ways if you guys want to help us support this, do new things, whatever. We have to talk about what that means, but you know, it was nice of someone to offer and we hadn't even considered that. So thanks very much, Joe. We appreciate it.
Yeah. That's exactly the stuff that I was talking about earlier on is the feedback gives us the wind to keep doing this. And, you know, even the, you know, if you guys want to support us by, you know, financially or whatever, that's all great. And that would be amazing. But honestly, just it's knowing that people, and just knowing that people are listening and making this feel like it's a big conversation and, you know, we're actually, you know, being heard and people are enjoying what we're saying and we get some feedback. That's really what we're after. So if you
like our Facebook page, I got to create an Instagram for us. I've got us on YouTube. I got to get our other episodes put up.
Yeah.
You know, just, we just need to know you're listening.
Yeah.
And that helps us get out there and find more interesting people to bring in and talk to you.
Totally.
Because we could talk to each other all day long.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, till next time, really looking forward to the next guest look forward to more conversations.
Yeah. Adios. See you soon, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the For the Reef podcast. As always, you can reach us at ForTheReefPodcast@gmail.com or via our websites, ForTheReef.com or SustainableMarineCanada.ca. If you would like to get involved and help the reef restoration efforts, check out our friends at CaymanEcoDivers.com. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please hit subscribe and join us for the next episode coming soon.